Welcome back to Presidents and Politics. I am one of your hosts, Professor Caleb McGee, joined by a fellow co-host, former Congressman Ross. We're going to talk about the 28th president today, Woodrow Wilson. That's a tongue twister. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I know, and Woodrow's not even his first name.
No, it's not. It's the old Southern thing of going by your middle name, which I have a lot of family members that do this as well. Of course, he's a deep Virginia boy. And he has a lot of issues from that, too. I mean, I know this is kind of early in the podcast to get into this, but he has some very backwards views on segregation, on race, on women's...
Well, it stays with him.
Right. It does. He struggles with this throughout his life. And in some ways, Wilson will be the one who institutionalizes segregation in D.C.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, so before we even kind of get going on some of the good things that he did, we have to stop and talk about the fact that he has a very dark spot in his legacy, and that is the institutionalization of segregation for the District of Columbia and specifically for government positions. And this will not be undone, of course, until the 50s and 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, with you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks and all those amazing leaders from the 50s and 60s. It really will not have its full reverse until then. So what he will institute will last for, what, 3 decades at least?
Yes.
At least 3 decades.
In 1902, he published a 5-volume textbook, The History of the American People, which presented a romanticized view of the Confederacy and described the Ku Klux Klan, a violent terrorist group, as, quote, roving knights, errant and invisible empire of the South, bound together in a loose organization to protect the Southern country of some of the ugliest hazards of a time of revolution.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Can you say spin doctor?
Yeah.
I mean...
And again, this is a guy who, you know, higher education, as you said earlier, that, you know, the first one with... The only one with a PhD.
The only president with a PhD, and I believe the only president with a doctorate, period.
Yeah.
But he's definitely the only president with a PhD. Brilliant mind. A tendency to be a little egg-headed at times. But
he was an academician.
He was.
You know,
he was. No, listen, I understand my peers. I get where you're coming from.
And he had a PhD in political science.
And there is I'm trying to think how to say this in a nice way. There is the temptation that the more education you gain, the more convoluted you make average everyday speech.
I think you're absolutely right.
And I see that with my peers all the time. It's a temptation I try to prevent myself from ever falling into. I think I have too much Okeechobee to fall too deeply into it. But this is a real reality with academic mindsets, that when you spend a lifetime reading and writing and studying and speaking and lecturing and presenting papers and sitting in seminars, you reach this point to where you have an issue communicating well with the everyday man. Wilson's not a populist candidate.
No.
He's not a Jackson.
No, in
fact, he's not a Roosevelt.
He holds himself out as a conservative.
Which is interesting.
But he's not.
Not in the least.
No, and that's what gets him elected.
Yeah. So he's running against, and this is one that we can really talk about, the application. He's running against both Taft and Roosevelt, which splits the party, right?
Correct.
And we talk this all the time, but Roosevelt and Taft are running as progressive Republicans. Roosevelt's much more progressive than Taft is. Taft is more of a constitutionalist. He still kind of labels himself as a progressive. And you have Wilson over here who is a progressive but kind of labels himself
as a conservative. Yeah.
And you're just going, okay, everyone's confused here. Can we just call a rose a rose, right?
Yeah.
A rose by another name is still a rose. If it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, it's probably a duck. So let's actually have truth in labeling. Let's have truth through truth and definition. And in this election that we have, that we see, literally every individual that's running is running on can we say the opposite ticket of what they really are? There's a lot
that's
of subterfuge that's used in this election.
And he wins with 42% of the vote because the other two split the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
But he has an overwhelming majority in the Electoral College. And he takes office as a conservative Democrat.
As a conservative academic Democrat.
Yes. And then much to the chagrin of those that supported him and put him there, he now becomes very progressive.
Very progressive.
And liberal in his policies.
Very progressive.
But you look back at he was raised, his father was a Presbyterian minister.
Yes, he's a PK.
Yeah.
That explains a lot, right?
Like you. You got the son of a minister, political science professor.
Exactly.
And so,
do I need the small glasses now? I mean, I have my...
We're going to run
what
you for
are those
governor.
Called? It's a French term, the little tiny glasses that
I
sit on
no
the nose.
Idea.
My Okeechobee dialect, the French wouldn't sound good anyway, right?
But the interesting thing is that he couldn't read until the age of 10 because of dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
He was raised in the South in Augusta because his father was a chaplain in the Confederacy, and they used his church as a hospital. And so he became familiar with the horrors of war, and he detested war. Mm-hmm. He was probably traumatized by it.
Which describes or explains maybe his thirst and his desire for peace throughout life. The League of Nations,
yes.
Everything he did was peace, 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 peace. And his desire to not to even get in World War I for so late. We don't come in until 1917.
Right.
And the war ends in 1918, right?
Right?
It's one of the shortest wars we were ever involved in. We were in this war, maybe the Spanish-American War might be a little shorter. Right?
Yeah,
the Splendid Little War,
right,
as it was called. But World War I is one of the shortest wars we were ever involved in. And Wilson wanted to stay out of war so much. Had Roosevelt been president, we would have been in war in 1914, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he wanted it so dang bad.
Yeah.
Like, he'd have been in war in 1914. But Wilson does everything he can to stay out of war. And I think what you're saying is one of the reasons why.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think that the guy, like all our presidents, I firmly believe, had the best interests of America at heart.
I think so, too.
And his background, you know, his wife dies in office.
Mm-hmm.
He remarries while in office. He wins his reelection by saying, you know, he kept us out of war. And then within months of being reelected, he gets us into war.
Is it Read My Lips, No New Taxes?
Yes, exactly.
And then months later, there's taxes?
Yeah.
I mean—
But he also did, you know, he started the Federal Reserve, which for those of you out there is the bank that it's a central bank that the banks bank with.
Mm-hmm.
He started the Federal Trade Commission. He put 8-hour days on the railroad workers, so he helped there. He was also president when the income tax went into law. But at the same time, he lowered the tariffs. So in order to make up for the lost revenues, you know, they increased the income tax. And he's also president during Prohibition and women's suffrage.
That's right.
That's a lot going on for this guy.
But he doesn't necessarily support women's suffrage. So he's mixed in this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some letters between him and Edith, who become his second wife. And I'm trying to remember the terminology. It's been a while since I've read this. The terminology he uses, but I believe he calls them devils in white skirts. And it was like I mean, the Christian Temperance Union could do some weird stuff, right? They're like running into bars and breaking open casks, and they could be very violent in the way they push their message forward. But so he doesn't necessarily support women's suffrage. And you bring up an interesting point. So when I teach my survey classes, this is one of the points I always bring up, especially for the females in the classroom, is I'm like, you need to understand how valuable it is to have the right to vote. When my great-grandmother was born, which I knew my great-grandmother, we're in the South, my great-grandmother was like, I think I was 8 when she died. So I mean,
Wow. Knew
her pretty well, had a lot of conversations with her. When she was born, she didn't have the right to vote.
Wow.
That's just how soon this is that we as America finally realized, hey, you know what? This is for every American citizen.
Correct.
This is not just for male. This isn't, as it was originally formed, this isn't just for white land-owning male citizens.
Right.
This is for literally every citizen. And we'll get into World War I in a moment. And I know we're kind of going on a tangent here of women's suffrage, but one of the things that was so brilliant that women did in order to get the right to vote is that two major arguments. One was we had the composure to work as nurses in the war, so if we dig bullets out of you, I'm pretty sure we can figure out who to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant argument. And their second argument was, now that we're in the workplace, we're working as teachers, we're working as nurses, we pay the same income tax you pay.
Yeah.
So either we're not going to pay taxes anymore, or we're going to have the same rights as a citizen to vote.
Can you believe that was even an argument back then?
Yes.
But I mean, that's the course of history of America.
Yes.
Some of the absurdities that we consider today were taken as commonplace back then.
And just a couple generations ago.
Yes. And yet, because of our system of government, because of our constitutional process, we resolve these and we move forward.
Yes.
And without, you know, having to get a new form of government.
That's right. There was not a revolution in a new constitution written.
Correct.
Right? Which would have happened in France or
any other place.
One of these other countries. France has had, 18 constitutions since the revolution?
Yeah.
Something like that. But we saw the one because our system works.
Correct.
Our system is.
And that's what we need to be teaching.
I don't believe that the Constitution is a living document. I believe in author's intent, but it's living in the sense that there are abilities for amendments to progress when
Correct.
It's needed.
Correct. I mean, we have the amendment process.
Yes,
and that
for a
has
reason.
Been there. The 14th Amendment. I mean, all of these amendments, the 13th Amendment, the
yes.
14th Amendment.
The 19th Amendment, as we're talking about.
With women's suffrage. I mean, our founders knew that we would have problems that we had not anticipated at the time of the writing of the Constitution, so they gave us a method by which we could address it.
Yes.
And we have. And we continue to do that, but it requires individual involvement and an obligation to know what's going on.
Absolutely. Knowledge is power. And I know that's, yes. That's such a trite saying, right? It's something that's been said since we were kids, right? Knowledge is power, and knowing is power. But it's true. Like, if you know something, you have the ability to do something.
Yes.
And that's the reason why education is so important. We use the phrase all the time, the dumbing down of America, but it's true. If you look at like magazines like Popular Mechanic from the 1950s, if you read through those, their vocabulary, their dialect, this is a blue-collar magazine. The way they wrote was actually higher than like the New York Times and a lot of academic journals in today's time.
Yes.
The Popular Mechanic in the 1950s, if you look through the sales ad, they would advertise the Great Works series, classic literature books.
Wow.
The Britannica. Like they would actually like here's a blue collar guy reading through how to fix his old Chevy. And you're actually, you know what? I think I'd like to pick up a copy of the Iliad from Homer. I have colleagues that haven't even read the Iliad, right? I mean, like,
that's some, yeah.
There is the dumbing down process of America. Not to say that if you haven't read the Iliad, you're dumb. That's not what I mean. My point is being able to comprehend or have good reading comprehension, to be able to just critically think through things.
Correct.
And as you said, the more that we lose this ability to critically think, the more you're going to see the rise of the nanny state. Because the more you're going to have the state want to take care of you.
Yeah, I think, and we're demanding that.
Yes.
You know, I mean, when I was in office, both in the state and federal, it was always like, there ought to be a law. You know, can you pass a law to do this? Can you pass a law to do that? Well, can you exercise personal responsibility?
Thank you.
Because we can't legislate personal responsibility.
We cannot regulate a correct society.
No. It requires the individual responsibility to do it.
We can create punitive action for abhorrent acts, as we should as a society. But when it comes to daily and personal responsibility, that's...
We have to practice it on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
Interestingly enough, though, even though he was a segregationist but he did appoint the first Jewish member of the U.S. Supreme Court, in Louis Brandeis.
That's right.
And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, he's a real stickler for the rules, which I think is why when women's suffrage came through, because he can have some anti-Semitic writings, but then he will appoint Jewish individuals. He just, if it fit the law and his textual understanding of things, he would do it anyway.
Yeah.
I remember reading a story, one of his biographers, I can't remember which biographer it was, who made the statement that when he was 9 years old, he played Little League Baseball. He's a baseball guy. Because this is the golden years of baseball, right?
Yeah.
This is the golden years of baseball. So when he plays baseball at the age of 9, he actually drafted a constitution for his Little League team for how they should both manage and behave. And here's this 9-year-old, and he drafts a constitution for his Little League team. So
I love it.
I guess this is the whole nature versus nurture argument, right? Like how much are we born with and how much is meant? He's born with this.
Oh, he's definitely born
with
this
legal textual mind.
Yeah.
And as you said, he probably can't even read yet because he doesn't want to read until 10, but he's already like drafting and thinking through this idea of a constitution, if you will, for his Little League team.
Yeah. And then he practices. He does become a lawyer.
Yes.
Practices law for a couple of years in Atlanta and says, don't like this. Goes back to school.
Yes.
And gets his PhD. Marries Ellen, and they have three daughters. And then she dies while in the White House, I guess, of a kidney disease.
Yes.
And he's bereaved and eventually marries Edith Galt.
Which War One is taking place, was heating up at the time when his wife is dying. I remember one biographer saying that he was holding the hand of his dying wife with one hand and he was writing letters to the heads of Europe telling them to calm down with the other hand.
Mm.
Which, that's a little bit of prose, but there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what's going on. So I guess we should probably touch some on World War One, the Great War, right?
Right, the war to end all wars.
The war to end all wars. It was the belief that this war was so heinous and so horrible that we would never have a war again.
Correct.
And yet, what, 20-something years later, we do it again.
Yeah.
But this was a war we've never seen before. And again, this isn't a podcast on war. I think we could do that later. Maybe we finish this, do a podcast on wars.
Yeah.
I don't know. But the Great War, which it was called the Great War at the time because there was no War II yet, right? No, you're going to call it War I, but there is no War II. So it was called the Great War at the time. When the Great War breaks out, we had never used mechanized industrial revolution technology for war. And now the factories, the conveyor belts,
engines, the industrial machine.
The industrial machine is weaponized.
Absolutely.
And we've never seen anything like this.
No. And nobody did it as well as Germany did. You know, especially with their U-boats.
Yes.
It just wreaked havoc.
Yes.
On the merchant marines.
Which was it 1915, they'll sink the Lusitania.
Yeah.
Which is a British ship, but it had a lot of over 100 American citizens on it. We still stay out of war. And then I believe it's 1917, they start the idea of unrestricted U-boat warfare.
Correct.
So now the Germans are saying anything on the sea is fair game. Can you imagine that in modern day times, if you had a country that's like any cruise ship, any American cargo vessel, any American naval vessel, anything on the open sea is a sitting duck and it's fair game for us. Yeah. How could Wilson not go to war?
Yeah,
Wilson,
you have to.
He had to. He did everything he could to stay out of war. And I think you said his childhood was one of the reasons why. He wants to avoid war, but there's two major elements that finally push him into war. The unrestricted U-boat or submarine warfare, right, which would have been enough, I think, for either one of us. If I'm sitting in the chair and I have a country, I don't care what country, that says anything you see on the ocean, we're going to pick off, I'd be like,
yeah, that ain't happening.
Let's see. Let's see. We're going to go to work now, right? I mean, I think that would be the response of any of us. And then the other one is the Zimmerman telegram. And there's a lot of questions about the Zimmerman telegram,
if this was
a forgery or not. Britain is dying yet again. They need help. And supposedly a British cryptographer named Arthur Zimmerman intercepts a telegraph between Germany and Mexico. Mm-hmm. And the telegraph tells Mexico, if you work with us and invade America from the southwest, then we will give you all the land back that America stole from you. So basically, Germany's idea is that Germany and its European powers will invade from the Atlantic through the East Coast, and then all of their allies will invade from the West Coast, specifically Mexico and her allies, and they're basically going to pincer maneuver the American country, which would have been a nightmare. Can you imagine, from a military mindset, trying to defend that?
That would be, that would, and especially as the evolving United States was at the time, we would not be prepared for
that.
We
just took the frontier. We just took the, I mean, there's, some of them are still territories, not many left, but we just took the Western territories. We have hardly any blockades. So if Mexico decides to come up through its allied forces, and then we're getting bombarded with U-boats on the East Coast, we would have fallen apart.
Absolutely.
So Wilson, with these two acts, is forced into war. Still doesn't want to go to war. Still
wants to do everything he can. He goes to Congress and asks for a declaration of war.
And he's the first president to speak in front of a joint session of Congress in, 100 years?
Yeah.
Over 100 years? And he'll do it something like 25 times in his presidency, where he will walk into the Capitol and stand in front of a joint session of Congress and speak. Did this happen when you were in Congress, by the way? I'm trying to think if it's happened
since. Well, the president would come with the State of the Union address.
Okay, so Union.
And then we'd do
but
that.
Other than the State of the Union, did you?
No.
Okay, I was wondering, because I'm trying to think the last time that happened. Did Bush do this with 9/11? I can't remember.
I think so.
It's probably the last time that's happened, would be probably Bush with 9/11.
Yeah.
But this is very rare. People don't, I hope our listeners understand, this is a very rare thing for a president to come down and address.
Yeah.
So it's like the executive power coming to team up with the legislative power and working together. First of all, imagine that, actually.
Yeah.
actually working together. But this is not a common everyday occurrence, right?
No, it is
but
not.
But throughout his presidency's tenure, he'll do this, like, I think, like something like 25 times.
Yes.
And this is one of the first times he'll do it. And we launch a world war. We don't stay in it very long, though. 1917 to 1918, and it's over. The thing that defines World War I is trench warfare. I can't imagine how nasty fighting that way must have been. So for our listeners, trench warfare was literally digging 5, 6, in some places, 7-foot-long trenches all across the European front. Specifically, northern France was most known for this. And basically, soldiers would fight in one trench. There was something called no man's land in
between,
which is like barbed wire, which was a new invention, right? Because we were defeating the frontier and we're fencing off. So barbed wire is actually a new invention. And then a trench on the other side. And basically, these groups would stick their head over and shoot at each other. And there's this no man's land. And every now and then, a commanding officer would give the order to go over the top, which is where that expression comes from. You had to jump out of your trench, run through no man's land, not get shot, fall down the other guy's trench.
And
which maybe there was like, it depends on the assault, 20 to 25% of people who actually lived to even get to the other trench. It's some of the bloodiest fighting that ever happened.
Yeah.
It led to something called trench foot. You're living in wet mud all the time. Guys' feet are like rotting off. It was incredibly horrific conditions to fight in.
And they used mustard gas. I mean, it was.
So it's the birth of biological warfare, which again, Wilson will set the precedence later with the League of Nations, of course, for wanting to outlaw a lot of these Geneva Conventions. It's 14 points. I'm pretty sure America and our allies, we're the only ones who actually follow them. We're the only ones
to this day.
We have rules of war, and yet only only a few of us actually follow these rules of war, which is just an interesting concept, by the way. I'm sure you had this a lot. I know you served in a lot of committees with military action, so I'm sure y'all probably address this a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But it's interesting that we created these rules of war and not many of us actually follow them. But the desire to move away from biological warfare came from this, the idea of mustard gas. It's the birth of aerial warfare.
Yes.
Because if you have trenches, well, what's the logical thing?
Fly over them.
The red bearing, right? I always tell my class, there's some really interesting stories at the beginning of dogfighting. Now, dogfighting means plane on plane, right? It's aerial warfare. So dogfighting, when it first was birthed, was basically like, planes, as they're going to drop things over trenches, they meet up in the air, and it's their enemy. So what are we going to do? Well, they don't have any guns mounted on their planes yet. So the very first time we see actual aerial warfare was basically guys throwing bricks at each other because they're open cockpits.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're open cockpits. It's the Sopwith Camel.
Yeah.
So basically they fly alongside and they start trying to throw bricks in each other's cockpit. And then they go, let's start throwing chains on their propeller. And then before long, they go, you know what, we can get sidearms, and we can just fly by and shoot in each other's cockpits. It's basically drive-bys. And then the British were the first to go, hey, we can mount a machine gun on our plane, which is kind of classic Florida, man. I feel like if there was a guy from Florida there, he would have done the sooner.
Yeah.
But he's like, we can mount a machine gun on our plane. And it sounded good until the first time they did this, they actually shot their own propeller
off. I was going to say, they had to synchronize it. Yeah.
Let's synchronize it and let's metal plate the back of our propeller. And now, when this is done, it births aerial warfare. And of course, like you said, the red bearing is the most famous out of this. But it has very humble beginnings at the beginning of World War One, and then we find ourselves in all out dogfights, which will carry through World War Two.
Oh, absolutely.
Korea, Vietnam, still and even do. To some extent, they still do. And you see a retraining of that. And there were some different incidents that have taken place recently that have actually led to retraining of dogfighting techniques.
Wow.
But yeah, so World War One is a fascinating war. But I think you probably want to touch on the idea of the 14-point speech and the League of Nations, right? This leads to Wilson's grandiose idea.
Yeah. You know, he's the one that coined the term, you know, the war to end all wars.
Yes.
He was a very strong advocate for peace. And in order to prevent peace, he was at the, you know, went lobbied in Paris.
He stays there for what, 6 months?
Yeah.
Can you imagine acting president, leaving your country for 6 months?
Yeah. And works on building the League of Nations. He uses his 14 points, and one of which was the League of Nations, which was the precursor to the United Nations.
Yes.
But you had a Republican Congress that did not want, and it was isolationist. The Republican Congress was isolationist. They did not, in fact, they felt that if we did the League of Nations, that may expedite us into another world war.
That's correct.
So let's don't do it. The president Wilson went and traveled the country trying to get the American people. He suffered a terrible setback in his health problems, and then went and suffered
some
a
form
stroke.
Of stroke.
Then he had a stroke.
Yes.
And unfortunately for him, Congress did not adopt the League of Nations.
Correct.
And
in fact, America is one of the few that won't actually join the League of Nations.
Correct.
France and almost all our allies do actually form and join the League of Nations. And then Wilson, who's in many ways can we say he's the architect, if you will, of the League of Nations?
Yeah, he was. And the interesting thing, you know, he gets a Nobel Peace Prize.
He does. 1919. Yes.
Yeah. But imagine also all the nations that joined it were the ones that essentially had on their home soil the war.
That's right.
And we didn't. And
That's right.
You know, would it have been different? Well, think about that. Would it have been different if we had actually been attacked?
That's good.
Would we have joined the League of Nations? And if we had joined the League of Nations, would it have prevented World War II?
And did Pearl Harbor lead us to join UN fashion because a little bit of our backyard got bombed then?
Yes.
That kind of plays off of your theory.
Right.
I agree with you.
Yeah, once you get attacked, then it's like, okay, we're going to need some allies.
It's like if somebody breaks in your house, let's go install the alarm system now.
Yeah.
I did it before, right? So it's again, we said this throughout the podcast, we're reactionary as human beings.
Absolutely.
And the government
is very
politics is even more reactionary
we're
than an individual.
Not proactive.
No.
And I'm not saying whether it was right or wrong to get into the League of Nations, but the fact that it was on the table gave you some sense that the world was changing now.
Yes.
You know, today we call it a global economy.
Yes.
Back then it was starting to become global.
Yes, that globalization.
Globalization,
happening.
Protectionism, and banding together that might have changed the course of history.
Do you think the Republican Party is still more isolationist than the Democrat Party? Do you think that's – I know we've definitely come a long way since the original.
Today I'd say the Republican Party is more isolationist.
Okay.
I think that they are more nationalist, if you will, and in doing so become more isolationist. I mean, you can see with what's going on with Ukraine, and I'm not commenting on whether that's right or wrong.
Agreed.
But the Republicans don't want to give any more aid to Ukraine. They believe we need to take care of what we have here.
It seems to be a growing trend in the Republican Party.
And I think that, you know, let's take care of ourselves before we start taking care of other people is the attitude of the Republican Party right now.
I agree.
You know, finding that balance is a difficult thing. And we'll see where it goes.
And I think another interesting thing we need to talk about as well, because I think this applies to modern geopolitics, is that this is the 1918 the war ends. So we're talking the 1920s kind of leading into this. It's kind of the era of hedonism. We call it the lost generation. All these guys have PTSD, right? But we don't know what PTSD is yet. We don't know what TBI, traumatic brain injuries, are yet. Think about if you watch this old black and white footage and you see the concussive force of those artillery shells. There's no helmets, no earplugs, no shit, like none of the safety precautions. You see like a guy hanging on a cannon and it's popping, his whole head is just getting concussed. So the TBIs are out of this world, one of the highest, and they just use the term shell shock. Yeah. You came back, you were all messed up, and they're just like, oh, he's got shell shock. We had no idea what it was. It's brain damage.
We minimize it.
We minimize it, which led to a ton of guys self-medicating through alcohol, which led to domestic abuse and alcoholism on the rise, which then led to reactionary prohibition. Yeah, let's just outlaw alcohol. Don't actually help the guy who's got TBI. Just make his one self-medication illegal. That'll fix things.
You're right.
And it led to organized crime. So you just see the reactionary moment of the 20s. And then in the 30s, we have the first of the Great Depression, obviously. But then you have the rise of something called appeasement, the geopolitical idea of appeasement. Let's not go back to war. No matter what we have to do, let's not go back to war. And what does it lead to? The rise of Hitler. The rise of Mussolini, the rise of the Japanese Imperial Navy. Basically, they can have all of the world they want as long as they leave us alone. So isolationism and appeasement allowed the Holocaust to happen, allowed the Nazi Party to happen, allowed the Italian fascism.
We can't ignore this.
And
that's the one thing that we as Americans have to understand, that by default, we are the world's policemen.
And that sounds so unpopular. Well, we've been beat up on that for years.
But it's a fact of life. And if we don't want that role, then we need to have somebody else do it. Maybe China will do it. You know? No, I'm being facetious, of course. But what I'm saying is that we have a responsibility because of the blessings of what we've had as a very productive and vibrant nation.
The strong should protect the weak, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that just an innate desire?
It is, but that means we should also be able to control it. And that's where we have to understand why it's so important, is that if we can control the conversation, if we can control the relationships, you know, we don't have to have boots on the ground. We don't even have – what happened when Russia – you know, the wall went down in Russia.
1989.
We should have been there economically to help the Soviet states that were now seeking independence. And unfortunately, they are still, you know, dependent on Russia itself. But I understand why we want to be isolationists. You know, we got to take care of ourselves.
I definitely understand that desire 100%. I think it's natural. It's inborn, right? I mean, think about from a very primal level, protect your family first, right? Like if it's between someone I don't know and my wife, my child,
Absolutely.
Right? I get that. I 100% get that. But at the same time, if you let everything around you go to heck, kept that Southeastern appropriate, before long, you have to realize that's going to begin to affect your family anyway, right?
It will.
Like there's only so long you can hold the fortress up.
You can't ignore it.
And I like that you talk about this idea of being the America being the world's police, because we can't ever win with this. You look at something like Vietnam, and again, I'm not going to comment on the politics of that, but you look at Vietnam and we took more criticism for being the world's police than ever before. Fast forward and look at Hotel Rwanda when we didn't intervene, and everyone's like, well, America, why didn't you intervene? So when we do intervene, it's all you imperialist colonists, you know, pigs jumping in.
Right.
And then we don't intervene. It's you had so much power and you let the innocent die. Which one do you want?
Exactly.
Right? So there, and like you said, there is a balance because we've done it horribly wrong on both sides. There's times we got involved.
There's
we probably shouldn't have gotten involved.
And the second surge in the Iraq war, when we went after ISIS, we became the advisors to the Iraqi people and let them fight their war. Mm-hmm. And as a result, when they were able to push ISIS back, they then went back to their villages because there weren't American soldiers there. There was the Iraqi soldiers. We provided them guidance. We provided them advice. We provided them armaments. And they were able to push ISIS all the way back through Mosul and out to where they were non-existent. Now, where Iraq is today is, you know, that's an issue that they have to deal with
Afghanistan Iran. Both.
Yeah. But there's a way to get it done, but you have to do it cooperatively with the nation that needs the help. And that's where we get the colonialism branding and things of that nature and nation builders.
The idea of dollar diplomacy, which has been called many times economic colonialism, right? It's kind of like we can't win. So when we do it by force, we're a colonialistic power, right? So when we do it by trade, then it's economic colonialism. And you kind of reach the point, it's like, okay, what do you want us to do, right?
But we can't ignore it.
No, but it's almost like when you almost feel like if you're the president, you'd want to walk into the UN or to NATO and be like, okay, no matter what I do, you're not going to be happy. So let's just go ahead and talk about, like, what is it that you want from us, right? And it does feel that way sometimes. And I think Wilson is the architect of the League of Nations, which was the very first time that we can find in recorded Western human history. There's a lot of different like Greek leagues and stuff earlier on. But it's one of the first times that we as superpowers and as powers come together as allies and go, we're going to sign a charter where we're all going to watch each other's back. It's the first time you have like a global alliance system. Right. Now, Congress, Republican Congress specifically, did not like the idea that if one individual power went to war, then everyone had to go to war.
Right.
That was the hang-up.
But we have it in NATO.
We have it in NATO.
Thank God we don't have it in the UN.
Thank goodness for that. Had Wilson moved on that point, they probably would have signed. We would have gone to League of Nations.
I think so.
I totally believe so. But that was the hang-up point. And I do understand the issue of that, right? So I've heard a lot of times when I teach on this, I've heard people that really complain about this. They'll say, okay, so what you're telling me is if a NATO member, if somebody attacks them, we are required by our law and by our agreement that we're going to go fight as if we were attacked. And you'll hear the argument, and I understand the argument. So you want my son to die for someone else's country,
mm-hmm.
right? That's a valid argument. That's a valid argument. I always tell my students this way. I always bring it down back to the very basic microcosm. When you're on the playground, right, and there's playground bullies, as long as you're the biggest guy there, it's okay. But what happens when there's someone bigger and they jump on you? Don't you want some friends who, if they jump on you, they're going to jump back on them, right? That's the idea from a very, like, just primal level that when we have friends that watch our back, we're safer. So now the whole entire idea of global alliances is expand that and say, okay, if we have other countries that watch our back, we're safer. So I guess if you can always make sure you're the biggest, you don't necessarily need the alliances. But even still, enough jackals can bring down a lion.
That's true. And, you know, and I won't comment on the effectiveness of UN, but it's highly controversial today that I'm not so sure it's the, anyway.
Which the UN and NATO are both kind of outshoots of the League of Nations. I don't know if our listeners really realize they're two separate entities that have different memberships and kind of different roles. The UN is more of the social, political side, and NATO is the more military side, but they both have the aims of peace. That's a quick way of saying it for our listeners.
Theoretically. The aims of peace. For a whole other podcast, what happened in Gaza on October 7th with the UN, it's a disgrace. But
agreed.
Another time. We have to talk about his health.
Yes, and then, of course, the role of Edith. So I'll let you, if you want to start on this.
Yeah, you know, after his wife Ellen dies while he's in the White House, he starts courting Edith.
Mm-hmm. Was writing up to 3 love letters a day. Yeah. I read one biography. Who has time for that? Like, you're the president of the free world in a war. How do you have time to write 3 love letters a day?
I know. But she...
But nonetheless, I digress.
And when he takes... When he gets the stroke, she takes over.
Mm-hmm.
She takes over the presidency.
She sets up a desk outside of his room and holds cabinet meetings.
Yes. We couldn't tolerate that today.
Can you imagine?
No. And that's why we have the 25th Amendment.
Yes. But it's vague. And I think you can touch a lot of it. The 25th Amendment is ridiculous, which I understand. Okay.
Congress can pass laws to say that the president is not capable of executing his office.
Yes. And you're a lawyer, so you get this better than anyone. But many times laws are written vague intentionally so there can be the interpretation. Yes. So I get that. I really do understand. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a lawyer's mind. That's definitely your area. I'm more theoretical than that. I understand. But the 25th Amendment almost seems even ridiculously vague for legal language, in my opinion. I don't know if you...
Well, it's never been applied other than the succession of the vice president to the president and the death or absence of the president. But when you look at the it is vague in terms of
how... Should it be more concrete in language?
Well, that's just it. I think that's what our founders knew, and I think those that have proposed amendments, is you can't make it that specific because it may draw more problems of unintended consequences.
Okay.
You know, the right of free speech. Well, does that mean you have the right to go, you know, yell fire in a crowded movie theater? Of course not. But that's where Congress has to come in and provide the guidelines to what's in there. And the 25th Amendment does allow, of course, it allows for the cabinet or other a majority of the cabinet or other department heads of the executive to issue a proclamation that the president is no longer fit to exercise his duties.
Which, can
as president.
We just say that almost seems like mutiny at times? That your subordinates hired by you, who are supervised by you, have the right that if they want to, they can come together and be like, I don't think he's fit anymore. That almost feels like it could be mutinous pretty quickly. I mean, I don't know. Maybe am I reading too much in this?
No. And then you've got the checks and balance of Congress. So Congress could come in. It also allows Congress to make laws to do the same thing, to set guidelines to say, oh, the president is not fit. But I hope we never have to execute the 25th Amendment under any circumstance, because that would be probably, I don't even know if a judicial decision from the Supreme Court would keep our country together.
Agreed. Because at that point, it is a coup. You almost look like a banana republic at that point.
Exactly.
You look like a banana republic running a coup that your own people declare you unfit. Something happens. You disappear and you have a new ruler.
Look at impeachment. Yep. You know, first used in, 1865, I guess, or 1866.
With Andrew Johnson.
Yeah. And then not again until Clinton, and now it's almost a common tool.
Yes.
You know, you exercise the 25th Amendment, suddenly becomes a political tool.
Absolutely.
You know, and
you weaponize it.
Exactly.
Yes.
And politicize it. So.
Yes. So there are the questions, and again, there's not a lot of clarity, but a lot of individuals believe that Edith was actually running the show. She's running the presidency.
Yes.
Now, she later came out, wrote her own autobiography, and talked about the fact that she was nothing more than a gatekeeper of information. Well, if you're the gatekeeper, you're running things, right?
Yeah.
If you control the information
you
that the leader sees,
this can come out.
Exactly. And I can't remember the exact specifics, but I remember reading a biography years ago that she even had a cabinet member that had like insulted her, and basically she like until he apologized, he couldn't even have a meeting with the president.
Yeah.
It's pretty petty, and that just shows how much power you have.
I mean, she did.
That basically makes you a despot at that point, right? Like if I don't like what you said.
Good point.
First of all, can we just say the immaturity of that, right? Are we five?
Yeah.
You know, you said I'm ugly. Well, you can't see the president now, right? Have we fallen to this? This is the leadership of the free world. Have we fallen to this? But there are questions, again, not naming any specific administration whatsoever, but there will be questions in the future about the 25th Amendment, right? How does this pertain to us as Americans? If you had a leader, again, theoretical, 100% theoretical, 4 years from now, 3 years from now, and that leader had a stroke, what happens?
Right.
If they're still alive, and let's say that they still say they have the competency to run the country, but everyone around them understands they don't necessarily have the clear competency they once had, what does that look like?
Well, and that's a good question. That raises the question of what would be the standard that the majority of the cabinet members would rely upon in order to say that the 25th Amendment needs to be invoked. Would it be, a panel of three psychiatrists and neurologists and neuroscientists or whatever? I don't know. But those standards don't exist.
And then who picks those doctors?
None of that exists in the Constitution.
Exactly.
So how that process is utilized is still out there.
Yeah, because you and I know this because we both live in the world of academia to some extent. Whoever writes the test can pretty much dictate who's going to pass the exam.
Yes.
Right? So if you have politicized physicians or psychiatrists or psychologists, whatever term you want to use, who's ever writing those, who's to say that they intentionally write the exam against this individual's weaknesses?
Correct.
Right? Or is it going to be some kind of a standardized exam? I mean, like, it's just – there's so many questions that become raised at this point.
Yeah, just think. I mean, you got 13, I think it's 13 cabinet members. So you get seven of them to say, okay, why don't we have these doctors give an opinion as to the fitness for duty of the president? And if it all comes back, you know, that he is not fit for duty, then the seven of us will vote to invoke the 25th Amendment. I mean, essentially, that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that would be.
That leads to some serious questions. So I think we've already gone a little long, but Wilson. Although his presidency, we may not agree with all of his political terms, he lives through very turbulent years.
Yes.
Very, very turbulent years. And I think one thing that we've enjoyed as we've talked about this is that Wilson, his presidency raises a lot of modern questions. If it's the 25th Amendment, if it's the policy of appeasement, if it's the idea of isolationism, there's so many things. And I think we're going to see this a lot now as we're moving forward with presidencies because we're getting so modern and so applicable, right? I think and Hardin, of course, is next week. And he has this idea post-World War I in the 20s. He even asked the question. He begins to talk about the fact that we want to return to normalcy. We're tired of this idea of constant stress in the American life. I think we're there again.
Yeah.
After COVID, after the different wars we've been through, after the political divide, after just the vehement division of the American people, I think we're going to see a generation. And we had this conversation in the 2024 election with some of our students saying, we just want some compassion and empathy in the White House. And I thought that was interesting. I don't know if you caught some of our students talking about that last week. We just want compassion and empathy in the White House again. And it makes you wonder if you're not going to see a candidate who's going to run that way again. Listen, let's just be normal and kind again and stop with all the theatrics.
Maybe 2028.
Maybe 2028.
Yeah.
Maybe is this generation that we're teaching, this Generation Z, as they rise up, I think they're going to start demanding that.
I hope so.
I hope so too, because it's time to see if we can use the term a kinder, gentler form of politics and civility to be rebirthed again.
Amen.
And I think Wilson is kind of at the end of the divisive presidents because, I mean, we have Taft and Roosevelt and Wilson, and they're all fighting, and it's all this inner fighting and this drama.
And then a world war,
And then a world war, and then a pandemic. The pandemic and the Spanish influenza outbreak, right? And then after that, after all this junk that we can kind of see mirrored for us, you have the return to normalcy. You have the 1920s, the baseball era, Harden. Maybe we could see that again.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. So this has been the 28th president, Woodrow Wilson. Thank you for joining in.